Episode 33.
That customer that is going to be new to us today is completely different than the value proposition that we've developed. The old car guys, they expect one kind of service, and the younger folks, the millennials coming in, they expect something different. And I think you have to be able to, in our situation, bring both of those models to the table effectively.
Welcome, aftermarketers. Prepare to learn just one thing from today's episode and take action on your journey to remarkable results. A warm welcome to Donnie Cipher of Cipher Automotive in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Donnie, are you ready to share your remarkable results?
Absolutely.
Hello, aftermarketer. Carm Capriotto here. Thanks for getting the word out and sharing this very special knowledge tree called a podcast. Our listenership is growing each week, and we've had thousands and thousands of downloads and people paying attention. I can't thank you enough. Co-owner of Cipher Automotive in Wheat Ridge, Colorado, Donnie Cipher is a third-generation owner and has over 30 years of automotive experience as a technician, manager, and service consultant. His dad started in 1961, and his grandfather was building race cars before that. Cipher Automotive provides general repair and maintenance with a special focus on diagnostic and difficult-to-solve problems. Donnie provides technical support to three ASE Master L1 technicians and one intern. Cipher Automotive also provides performance and restoration services for 50s through mid-70s American-made vehicles, specifically muscle cars. As part of his duties in that area of the business, Donnie re-engineers suspensions, engines, fuel systems. He integrates late model powertrains because people want them to go faster, emission control systems, body controls, HVAC systems, and you're going to love that discussion. Donnie's an ASE Master L1 Advanced Diagnostic Technician and C1 Service Consultant, and since 1994, he has been a participant writing test questions and working on passing score studies for ASE on A4 suspensions and steering, A2 automatic transmission, B5 body mechanical, and C1 service consultant. For many of these tests, Donnie has been in every writing session to date. Listen for a very strong dialogue on key points as he sees it that will shape the future of our industry, specifically his view of the future of shops and where Donnie feels our future techs will come from. You may have never heard this answer before, and he says you've got to pay them for their talent, so you can have the discerning customer who wants you to manage their connected vehicle. And in a very frank statement, Donnie says, if you don't have the passion for people or technology, you may want to rethink your stake as a service professional. His bio is long, but you're in for a short and straight-up discussion with author, trainer, business owner, ASA chairman, NASTIF, and NATEF member, and that's just the short of it. Listen to the passion of Donnie Cipher. Here we go. So where's Wheat Field? Is it in the foothills of the Rockies? Tell me.
Yeah, Wheat Ridge is right between the foothills and Denver. You throw a rock across the street, as I'm fond of saying, you hit Denver.
And so you get up every morning and you see this awesome sight?
Absolutely. Ugh. That's the greatest thing about being here.
Ugh, I love it. I love it. How exciting is that? Right up front, an author, a speaker, an ASE master, L1 technician. You're involved with ASE and writing questions. I actually did that once for parts people. That was a blast. Mm-hmm. You know, you're the ASA chairman. I hear about all the supplier engagements you're with. You're a Cub Scout, a Weeblos pack leader. How incredible. And then the girls' soccer coach. And then you're involved in a local radio station. And so my biggest question, I have actually four or five of them. And one of them is, when do you sleep? Number two is, how can you do all this? And there are people that still never join associations. And then how do you find your credible work balance?
It's definitely a challenge. I would be, from the work perspective, if my father weren't there right now. Now, he was a chairman of ASA many years ago, back in the late 90s.
Sure.
So I covered for him. Now he's covering for me. If he weren't there, we probably couldn't do this because I am spending a lot of time away. But we had a lot to do, so it makes sense. But the other thing is that, you know, you have the whole list of everything that I've done, and I'm not doing them all at the same time.
Right.
In fact, my kids just outgrew the soccer thing, so I don't get to be a coach anymore. That was a lot of fun.
I bet you. I did the hockey thing with my son back in the day. So did you grow up in the family business?
I did. Yeah, I'm third generation.
You're third. Mm-hmm. The statistics for three generations is not good. It's like 90% don't make it. So allocates to you on how you made that thing happen. So what is the best sage advice you've ever received from your father?
Well, I started out as a professional musician. So the best sage advice I ever got from my father was, you better have a backup plan no matter how good you are.
I have to tell you, there's probably thousands of people that can relate to that. So what instrument did you play?
Guitar.
Ah,
and I sing.
And you sing, and yes. And you never, I saw your bio list, there's no band on there. Should there be?
There isn't now. I did an a cappella thing with some friends that go clear back to junior high school for a couple of years, but with all the things I'm doing right now, it just got kind of to be crowded.
What mark do you end up thinking about you want to leave on this world?
I think for me, I really enjoy helping people, and particularly people that repair cars. I have this affinity for automotive technicians, and you know they don't always know what's going on outside of their world, and it's hard for them to. So I kind of feel like I really enjoy being outside and being able to bring something back, whether they ever know we did it or not. They'll feel it if we do it right.
I was talking to one of my podcast guests this morning, and he talked about, actually, you were at his place last weekend, Andy Masol.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I interviewed Andy this morning, and I'm not sure when any of your podcasts are going to reach the internet. We were having a discussion about technicians, and you just brought that up. You know, there's almost, we were discussing, should there be an association for technicians, or is IATN the thing?
Well, I think IATN is really a positive way for them to talk back and forth. I feel that ASA is in a position to really bring some things to technicians. Yes, we represent the shops, but they work in shops. So we're really working toward bringing more things to them. ASE obviously has done a lot for them, trying to develop that relationship that they should have with the world, that these guys aren't just monkeys that turn wrenches. It drives me crazy. And the people that are recommending careers saying, oh, you don't want to do that. Well, I think that's going to get really interesting in the next few years.
I'm releasing a podcast this Friday, and it may then let people understand the day that we're actually recording. And I interviewed Dr. Craig Clark, who's the dean of the Automotive Technology Program at Alfred State College here in New York. And they're graduating a couple hundred kids out there every year in their automotive trades program with an AOS degree, occupational studies degree. He says something that's so profound, and our people would have already heard the podcast by now. Because I asked Dr. Clark, I says, where are the graduates going? He says, to dealerships. And I said, why? He says, they're the only ones coming to recruit.
You're absolutely right. And that's something that we're really focusing on, is how can we change that approach? But the first thing we have to do is teach our shop owners how to be mentors.
Yeah.
And, you know, we recently brought Jeff Peavy on at AMI to run AMI, which is a huge get for the Automotive Management Institute. And I approached Jeff with that right away. I said, Jeff, can we do a class on how to mentor? Because we can't go after AES and all these students coming out of school until we know how to bring them into our environment. And he said, Donnie, I'm there. We're on it. So that's, I think he'll do a really good job.
How many people are you mentoring?
Me right now, I don't have anybody young in the shop except for two young techs that are really moving along well, and really they're just in time kind of mentoring right now. So what I've really been focusing my energies right now is I work with NATEF, and I'm trying to think of how many ways we can try to keep, even in the dealerships, keep these guys in our environment, because they're not staying. And so I'm really taking more of a 30,000-foot view and trying to be there right now, because there's not really very many people from the independent side of the industry that are there.
Well, look, let's do an interview with an ATEF person. So do me a favor, hook me up, connect me, and let's do more awareness through this content system that we're working on here.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Donnie, if you're not changing, you're stuck. And if you're stuck, you're not going forward. Do you have any special disciplines on how you implement change?
I wouldn't say special disciplines. You just have to stay after it, and you have to recognize there's going to be times when you're asking yourself, why did I do this? But you're absolutely right. And even if it's an incremental thing, that's one of the things that we try to do at the shop is make them incremental. I like big changes. I'll just decide someday I don't like the way I'm doing something, and I'll just start doing it a different way. That doesn't work with a lot of the people that are technical in our industry. They kind of like their patterns, and there's value to their patterns because that's what makes them good process thinkers. So you really have to kind of pick it off a little at a time. And for me, in my type of personality, I have to just be careful about not pushing too hard, too fast.
So wholesale changes don't work in your environment?
Yeah, I don't think so. Not in an auto repair environment.
I get it. How about staying on the theme change? Can you recognize a significant change in you as a leader since you joined the family business?
I would say yes. When I first came on, I had the real challenge of having a technical staff who I had grown up with. So here I am managing the business. Dad's gone. These guys are like my uncles, and I'm directing traffic.
Sure.
And so my management style had to be completely different from my dad's, because I had to be more of an influencing manager and say, hey, guys, the customer needs this. Can we do this? And you can't run back there and tell somebody who's almost twice your age, would you get your button gear? It's not going to work. So that really has, I'm struggling right now with that. People in this chairmanship job with ASA, People are looking at me and expecting me to be bossy, and that's just not my style.
Got it. I understand. Well, you seem to be a very intelligent adapter in so many sons growing up in a family business, having to now wield your influence to the peers you worked with. Great point. Hey, what's the latest book you read?
Oh, I got interested in writing historical fiction. I've done a lot of magazine articles and things like that. Yeah. And so I wrote this short story. And my editor at Motor Age at the time said, "So when are you going to write it?" I'm like, "I did. It's done." "No, I mean, this is a good story. You should write this thing." And so I started working on it, and I didn't realize that probably historical fiction, short of nonfiction, is the most difficult thing to write if you really want to paint your story over real history. And so I've got a book that I just finished. It's called Spectre Rouge. It's about a pair of custom coach builders that are in New York City that build, at the very end of the whole custom coach build deal, they build a car for a girl who's a singer. So I get to use all of my disciplines, and then the whole deal of the car getting shipped to Europe right as the war breaks out in France, and them trying to get themselves in the car back out because she's got Jewish background and has a history of someone who's after her family. And so it's that kind of a thing. It's kind of exciting, and it is absolutely correct on cars without putting women to sleep. That's my goal with that.
Well, that's great. How many pages?
Right now, it's about 370 in the first draft.
That's a big book.
And I had to really discipline myself for it not to be bigger. I wasn't trying to write War and Peace.
Well, I hear you talk about Coach and sending it overseas. And uniquely enough, Cypher Automotive has a specialty business. And I guess it's your love. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you question if you're wise doing it, but we just enjoy it, so we do it. We specialize in restoration, mechanical repair, and hot rodding of American muscle car generation primarily. But we really like the 40s cars and the 50s cars. In fact, I love 50s cars. And so we work on a lot of those, and it winds up being sort of a group of cars. All of a sudden, we've got lots of Mustangs and Camaros because a lot of those companies in our market have gone out of business for underpricing themselves. And then we've got a lot of Cadillacs, a lot of Lincolns, and then, of course, Fords and Chevys. And we don't have a lot of Chryslers, oddly enough, but they're just so much fun to work on. And, of course, a lot of them are attached to old guys. And the old guys have had these cars, or they had them in high school, and now they can afford to have them again. And it's just really fun putting them back in the car they had in high school, although they remember them a lot faster than they really were. So the trick is...
can you do something to my engine, can you do something to my transmission, I can't imagine.
This isn't as fast as it was in 1967. Well, that's just because Mama's SUV is faster. So, you know, we got to warm them up a little more.
Great, great story. Let's talk about the parts business, the parts side of your business. You've got a lot of responsibility when you buy parts for your customers. What makes you choose those parts?
Well, first off, we're a Napa Auto Care Center, and you know, this will sound funny, but I used to ride my bicycle down when I was still on a bicycle as my only transportation to pick up parts from the local Napa store.
Sure.
Dad would say, could you run down and get this real quick? You know, and so we've been with Napa for a long time. We have a great relationship with them, and so they take good care of us. I work with them on a national level as well, and they it really works in our market. They're a good provider. They're a really good source for pieces, and of course they cover a lot of our older cars too, and with some pretty good depth.
That's great. What are you doing to get technician training? I guess how many hours? What kind of classes are you working with Napa to be sure that they're bringing the training to you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm one of Napa's trainers, and I do the Denver market. So for my shop, there's a sort of a double-edged sword here. I'm trying to bring training to the Denver market, and so I get to bring kind of my friends in and say, hey, would you come teach all of our guys? And then on the other side of the coin, Napa asked me if I would teach in the Denver area for them, and so I get to sort of tweak the classes and fine-tune them, because we've had a culture of learning in the Denver area for many, many years because of guys like my father and Jim Tapp and a lot of the business owners that have been around for 40, 50 years. And so you bring average training to this market and the techs are falling asleep on you.
Yeah, they thumb their nose at it.
Yeah, so we really have to kind of take topics that they think they know and bring them the latest and greatest versions of them and say, you do, but you got to update. So that's important to me.
Are you doing technical and business management?
I don't do business management for Napa. I just do the technical. I do business management, freelance for other organizations. And my primary focus there is on lean and how to integrate lean into your business.
Well, let's talk about that, because my next question was going to be, describe for me a workflow process that you've recently upgraded that really helped your business out.
Lean is where we really try to focus. And so what we're working on most right now at Cypher Automotive is the seven deadly wastes. Waiting to me is what every time I do this class with a group is the number one waste that they all struggle with. And so what waiting is anytime you're not able to be productive. And most of those are self-induced. Others are not self-induced, but we don't come up with a solution for them. So a simple example of something that we're doing at the shop is when parts come in, even if the tech's not ready to work on that car, he verifies that they're right. Seems stupid, seems easy, but think about how many hours you lose, particularly if that part had to come from a warehouse. And so it's just an easy way to say, okay, I don't need this for 3 hours, but this gives my service advisor a chance to, if the part's wrong, to make sure we get the right piece.
It makes so much sense. After that, where does the part go?
After it's checked out?
Yeah.
We have this whole system that we've developed so that all of those parts, as they come in, they go in little baskets. They're color-coded baskets. And if the car is not coming in for several days, let's say we place orders ahead of time, we throw them in there. We throw a copy of the repair order in there so that if you go to that basket and say, what the heck are these things for? Oh, I see, they're for this car and it's coming in on this date. Or so that the technicians don't have to come try to get hold of a service advisor who's on the phone constantly if we're doing our job and say, where are my parts? So this way they can see the parts are there on the shelf and they don't have to chase each other around to figure it out.
What's a big concern or threat right now to your business?
I think the biggest threat right now that I'm experiencing is that a lot of us that have been in the business for a long time, we kind of feel like we're stuck. And so I've really been kind of analyzing our business, and I haven't pulled the trigger on everything yet, but we had these models that were killer, that worked so well, and now they don't work anymore. So I think the biggest threat to businesses like ours that have been around for a long time, I mean, Dad started in 1961, and my grandfather was building race cars before that, is that the value proposition for that customer that is going to be new to us today is completely different than the value proposition that we've developed. The old car guys, they expect one kind of service, and the younger folks, the millennials coming in, they expect something different. And I think you have to be able to, in our situation, bring both of those models to the table effectively.
So you, what you're saying is that you're treating customers differently?
Yeah, they expect to be treated a lot differently. You know, the old days, you could have, dad could be in the shop and that someone had come in and they could have a conversation about what needed to happen. And if you said, well, I can't really give you a price till I look at the car, that was logical. That made sense.
Mm-hmm.
The millennials, they're like, well, I can find this price here and I can find that price there. And so now you've got the whole conversation of, yes, and I could give you 15 as well, but are they what you need? And are they right? And so it's a real challenge because that information is readily available immediately. We're kind of adjusting our model to be able to provide a lot more information before that car even comes in, which means service advisor time gets used up sometimes on that, not doing something that's going to pay the bills. But hopefully at the end of the day, if you do it well, it turns into a job.
So the model has a bunch of different process loops in it depending on the customer and the need.
Yeah, and I think you have to be sensitive to that because you can't just adjust the model to this is what the millennials want, so this is the way we're going to do it, because you're going to alienate an audience that in our case may have been coming to us for 40 or 50 years in some cases.
So technology, you mentioned millennials, and I know you've done a ton of work. You're an outspoken leader when it comes to telematics. Now, I just dropped that for a reason, because my question really is, how do you see technology affecting our industry?
Oh, I think it's going to affect our industry in a lot more positive ways than negative ways, as long as we are in the conversation now. I think that I get a lot of pushback from some ASA members saying, why are we worried about this right now? Well, because it could very well be the next battlefield. And we don't need a new battlefield. We need a discussion. And so, you know, yes, I recognize that I may not even be working on cars by the time this autonomous cars become reality. But we have to have that conversation now. So I think that technology is going to bring a lot of things to the table. One, the way to touch and communicate with customers is changing. And there are some in our industry that have already, they're there. But so much of the repair shop owners, they don't understand that this technology is there, they could use it. So I think there's going to be a lot of changes there. The threats, of course, are obvious. If marketing through the center stack of the car becomes a big deal and customers actually buy into that, because frankly, if it's me, I'm shutting it off. I mean, I don't want to be advertised to while I'm driving. Then that could be a real problem if independents don't have the same access to that dealers do. But we're working on that. I mean, we're having that conversation now.
Well, I hope someday that my podcast will be played on the center stack someday.
Yeah.
for all of our listeners. You did a great article in Aftermarket Business where the OEMs in the industry met on telematics. I want to read something. It says the outcome was not nearly as important as the fact that almost 70 leaders who have often been described as the Hatfields and McCoys, I loved that, talked for at least 3 hours seeking an understanding on the challenges of the aftermarket's needs related to telematics and vehicles. And it's a great article. What did it take to pull this together?
It's actually a 10-year process to get here. As you're probably aware, and a lot of your listeners are aware, ASA took a very unpopular position on right to repair years ago. We believed that drawing a line in the sand with a piece of legislation was just simply that, and that when we were wrong, which we were going to be, about what we needed, that it would be hard to go back and then rewrite that again. So we really wanted to have a collaborative relationship with the OEs, and there were a lot of folks that didn't trust that. And so, you know, this is sort of the payoff for trusting that process for so long. So we went to the OEs and said, we need to do this. And they said, we agree, we need to do it, but you have to be the conduit, because if we reach out, it's not going to happen. So we reached out to organizations that ASA had been combative with, which, you know, I hated, but that just wasn't the management style of ASA at the time. And it finally came to a head where we just said, okay, we're changing our approach. And if you don't like it, you're not going to get to stay. So here we are. We got this meeting together and put them all in the room and basically said, okay, what you can't do is pick on each other. But what we need you to do is talk about what your challenges are. And I was really impressed with, I mean, these guys are the leaders in the industry, clearly. But even given that and their passion about all of this, they did such an amazing job of talking to one another and being respectful that that's why we got so far.
Wish I was a fly on the wall in that meeting. Wow, great. And thank you for doing that. You're one of the busiest guys that I know of. So where do you see yourself in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, I don't know that. I think I've sort of created a place for myself that it will be extremely difficult to leave. Not only from the aspect of I think I'll just keep getting calls to do this stuff, even when I'm not the chair of ASA, but also because it's a lot of fun. There's just no way around it. Last week, I was speaking to Fifth Avenue investors and stood in front of them and said, okay, I hate telling you guys about our industry because when you guys buy into it, you usually screw it up. And I don't want you to do that. I want you to actually understand how we work. And then the next day, I got to speak to this whole group, this IAP 20 group, about telematics. I mean, it just doesn't get any more fun than that.
I hear you, man. Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it and you see no end in sight because we sure can use your insights. With all your industry prowess, where do you see us heading, the industry, the aftermarket, in the next 3 to 5 years?
It's interesting. I actually think I have reasonable answers for that now that all the investor guys made me think about
it. Okay.
I think that there won't be a dramatic change 3 to 5 years. I think 3 to 5 years, our biggest challenge is having enough IT capability within our shops to start working on some of the things that are going to start breaking. And I think it's going to be sort of like reprogramming has been for the last few years. If you're pushing away, particularly a millennial who wants to be connected their entire life, wherever they're at, if you're pushing away repairing their center stacks and their communication capabilities and all that, you are pushing a customer away. So I think that's the short-term biggest challenge is that IT piece. And I think we need to get the kids that do that from different places. I don't think we get them out of OTEC schools. I think we get them out of gifted and talented programs. I'm working with the STEM program at Wheat Ridge High School who just won their division in the Shell Eco Challenge in Detroit. And this teacher did nothing to tell these kids how to do it. He just provided them tools and then sort of pushed and steered a little bit. Amazing, amazing instructor. And I got to help with some of that stuff that they did. And those kids are the answer to a lot of our technical problems because they're not really great at socializing, but boy, do they get involved with machinery and just adore it. So I think that's the short term. We got to get some people into the industry and be able to pay them. This is going to be another key. You can't be thinking about a $15 an hour model because forget it, it's not happening. But we've got to get that piece done. But down the road, I think we need to continue to be involved in this whole connected car discussion because I think if you sit by for 5 or 6 years and do no incremental learning, you're dead. It's going to be very hard to catch up.
Dead in the water. I mean, just the investment alone. Give me an idea of a single shop and what you feel, just believe a gut decision, you know, just shoot it to me. They would have to invest in every year in technology upgrades.
Well, I think that what we're going to see is the actual cost of the technology is going to go down quite a bit. Here's why I think that. One, I think it's going to be absolutely critical that there's a piece built into the car that is the firewall between the world and the car and its owner. The OEs are still not real comfortable with this, but they seem to be warming up to it. And the aftermarket has been too aggressive about pushing it on them. But I think we're starting to find middle ground on that. So I think that that's going to handle some of the diagnostic capabilities. I think what the investment's going to be is J2534 or similar type interface boxes. And they're not too bad. I mean, you can get them for $1,500, $1,800 now. I think that's going to be an incredible piece. I think your investment's going to be human capital.
So what you're saying is just don't lag behind, because
in your head,
in the training piece, and in making sure you've got the right talent to work and pull those levers.
Yes. Don't overbuy technology, because we tend to go out and buy $30,000 scan tools that we have no guarantee are going to actually even be able to work in a couple of years. And in my experience, a lot of times they don't.
Is there a lot of sharing going on with that?
As far as the information for the tools?
No, the local guys in the area, I'll buy this, you buy that, you buy this, and they share it.
There are some that are going that way. We have a group of repair shops that we don't, it's not planned that way, but everybody knows what everybody else has got. And somebody will say, hey, can I swing by and use your tool?
Or, okay.
So yeah, I think there's a lot of that, particularly when you've got a group of specialists that all kind of live fairly close to each other. We've got a good friend that's Volvos and Audis and that kind of stuff. And I don't go there. So I send stuff to him. He sends stuff to me. And so we both wind up servicing all the manufacturers between the two of us.
Donnie Cypher, I can't tell you how much I appreciate. Great insight. I think we could talk for an hour and I won't get bored. I know that for sure. So as I sum up our entrepreneurial podcast here, give us some words to live by.
Words to live by. I think that the biggest thing about auto repair is it's one of the hardest jobs there is, and it's not a job where people just go, oh, you are the greatest. If we were brain surgeons, you know, everyone would say how great we were. We're kind of undervalued. We work too many hours. So if you don't have a passion for some piece of this, whether it's the people or the technology or hopefully both, I just don't think you're going to be happy with this going down the road. And so I think you have to find your passion. You have to find the thing that clicks for you and makes you want to do this job.
Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Herm.
Thanks for being on board to listen and learn from another inspiring aftermarket professional. Until next time.